The Morning Show. The Home Team. No, it's both. It's The Crossover with Sam Franco and Chris Brame.
Crossover, step back!
That's a buzzer! Right here on 960theref.com.
What is up, Athens, and really anywhere, because this is the internet, so you could be listening to us anywhere. This is the Crossover Podcast on 960theref.com and on iTunes. Sam Franco and Chris Brame along with you. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got plenty to get to today. We'll talk about the Falcons and them extending Devontae Freeman, making him the highest paid running back in the NFL for now. We'll also talk a little bit about just the way that a guy is perceived, and that came from Deshaun Watson, who made his debut last night. We're recording this on Thursday, so Wednesday night he made his debut for the Texans, and it's just kind of funny how the commentators were talking about him and really what the future for the Texans could be with him at quarterback. But I want to start with an exchange I had. I was on vacation last week, and I was at the Lollapalooza Music Festival in Chicago. And since it was in Chicago, I was bound to run into some Notre Dame fans. And there was one guy in particular who me and my buddies had a discussion with.
Now, were you wearing Georgia gear?
I think one of my friends was wearing Georgia gear at the time. I think I was wearing some Atlanta United stuff.
Okay.
But we saw him first. So we were like, oh, Notre Dame. So, you know, we started talking to him about the game. And the funny thing was, he was very adamant that Notre Dame was better than Georgia at both the running back and tight end positions. And we really were confused. It's like, what games were you watching? You know, your team did go 4-8 last season compared to a Georgia team that, you know, didn't have a great season, but definitely didn't go 4-8.
Yeah. Did you ask him how much Molly he had been doing?
Well, you know, that's something you've got to worry about at Lollapalooza for sure. I was like, you know, did Malia Obama pass you that joint she was smoking a few years ago?
Did you run into her?
I did not.
Okay.
But apparently she was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not run into her. I did not see any Secret Service agents walking around. But it was a great time. Had fun. I know a band that you enjoy and you use on the Home Team, Arcade Fire. They were the closeout band on Sunday night, and they were phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm going to go see them in Vegas in October.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That'll be good. I will. Have you seen them before?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I was just, so you know that they're good live. But
oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were phenomenal live in Chicago at Lollapalooza, so much so that I'm probably going to buy a ticket to go see them when they come this fall to the Gwinnett Arena or the Infinite Energy Center over there. But anyway, we get back to the main point of discussion, and that is Georgia and Notre Dame. And my real question is, like, what – like, and he didn't, you know, I kind of tuned in and tuned out because, you know, you're at a music festival, so you're trying to watch who you're seeing in front of you. But it's like, what sane person, other than a fan of Notre Dame, would think that Notre Dame is better than Georgia at Georgia's two deepest positions on the field, I would say, in tight end and running back?
Well, no sane person would, and that's why there might have been some intoxicants involved with that guy. But I mean, they do have a very good tight end, and I mean, their wide receivers are all, I think the shortest one is like 6'4", mm-hmm. and one of them, the Equanimeous St. Brown, who has a great name, by the way, is projected a late first round, maybe high second round pick in next year's NFL draft. And, you know, Georgia does not have a bunch of like big guys in the secondary. And, you know, that is just one little area where I think the front seven for the Dogs defensively is going to have to bring it that day, because there are definitely some matchup issues that Georgia could have with their tight end and their wide receivers. But, I mean, I can't name their running back, though.
Well, if you look
at Jerome Bettis still there, Ricky Waters.
If you look at overall depth, though, I mean, yeah, they might have one good tight end. But, I mean, you look at Georgia, they've got Isaac Nauta, who may be the best tight end in the country. You've also got Jeb Blazevich and Jackson Harris, and those are just the top three. I mean,
yeah, and I mean, whatever you, how do you categorize Charlie Warner, who I guess
right.
you could lump in there too, but no, I mean, I wouldn't trade Georgia's tight ends for Notre Dame's, and I certainly wouldn't trade Georgia's running backs for Notre Dame's.
No, absolutely not.
The receivers, I would.
Well, right, but that's because they have done very well recruiting that position, but this game is obviously going to be very important for Brian Kelly, and both teams have an interesting start to the season. You know, Georgia hosting Appalachian State. Not an Appalachian State team that's going to catch anybody off guard unless you're Butch Jones in Tennessee, but not a team that anybody's overlooking anymore. And Notre Dame hosts the champions of the American Athletic Conference in Temple.
Yeah, I mean, so both teams have, you know, potentially tougher mid-major opponents than you would normally expect. I mean, if you know, include, I mean, especially Temple, when you think about how wretched they were not that long ago.
Right.
But, you know, but still, both teams are at home. They figure to be 1-0 there. But, you know, you're right. It is a bigger deal for Notre Dame and Brian Kelly because off that 4-8 season, and he's done the thing now. He's got a new offensive and defensive coordinator. So who's next if things don't work out? And they don't play in a conference where, you know, if Georgia goes to South Bend and lose,
they still got everything in front of them because they can still win the SEC East and get to Atlanta to play in the SEC title.
Right. Notre Dame doesn't have that to say. All Notre Dame has is we just lost at home to Georgia and, you know, we're 1-1.
And they've got a tough schedule with USC on it, with a Stanford on it. So, you know, they always have a relatively tough schedule. I say Stanford. I don't know if they actually play.
Oh, yeah, they still play Stanford. Okay. I guess it's Michigan. Maybe
they play Michigan State sometimes. And
well, they're going to play Michigan again, I think, next year, but they're not playing them every year. I think they still play Sparty every year. But Michigan is the one rivalry that got sacrificed for them playing.
And jumping to the ACC, so to speak.
Yeah. So they play Miami again,
right.
I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, they have that de facto ACC schedule, but they also still always play some teams, and you know, Stanford and USC being two of them. So they definitely have some tough games. And you're right. They don't have the liberty of going out in the non-conference because, A, they don't have non-conference. They're all non-conference. And, B, they don't have that thing to fall back on where the Georgia does, where it's like, well, we lost this game, but we can still take care of business in the SEC and still have a lot to play for left. You know, Notre Dame probably can lose two games a year and still be in the discussion for the playoff, but that's not a lot of wiggle room.
No, and, you know, and then it's just if it – a loss that early too, when you're coming off a 4-8 season, it just, you know, the heat is going to turn up there again too. And then, you know, what direction does the team go from there? Do they rally around that, or is it just create this big sinkhole and they fall flat? Because I mean, the reality for Georgia is it's the least important game on Georgia's schedule this year. I mean, if you ask me right now, if Georgia's going to go 11-1. You get to pick what game they lose.
Well, you're talking about against big opponents, right? Because obviously Samford, it isn't super important, and
well, no, but I would say I would rather lose at Notre Dame than lose at home to Samford.
Well, of course, okay, I see.
So yeah, you're right. I mean, the Notre Dame game is much bigger than Samford, sure, but I mean, I would much rather lose at South Bend than lose at home to Samford.
Well, of course, so. And definitely Georgia going to have a lot on their plate. When you talk about hot seat coaches, it's funny because Brian Kelly is definitely one of the coaches that's on the hottest seat in the country. I think you look around, even in week one, you've got arguably the two hottest or two of the hottest coaches going against each other, and Jim Mora Jr., or it's not really Jr., but Jim Mora and Kevin Sumlin. I mean, yep. They definitely have hot seat game right out of the gate for Butch Jones. If he loses that Labor Day night game to Georgia Tech in Mercedes-Benz Stadium, it does not get any easier because in September he still has to play Florida and he still has to play Georgia.
Yeah, and so he's got a new AD and a new chancellor, president, and all that too. So yeah, that's just going to make the pressure even added there. And also, coming off, it was a flop of a season for them. But yeah, I mean, I would think right now Brian Kelly's number one. You know, and then maybe Mora, Sumlin, Butch Jones are kind of all in about the same spot. But, yeah, when you just look at the schedules, I mean, the thing, yeah, we know Mora and Sumlin. One of those guys is going to be 0-2 right out of the gate. And, yeah, I mean, Butch Jones does have a tough September. And if they've got three losses, which would be coming off that Georgia game, and then I think they have the bye before they play South Carolina, it could be an interesting off week in Knoxville.
Yeah, no, it certainly could be. And I think Jim Mora's seat is made even hotter by the resurgence of USC here as a team that – is number four in the coaches' preseason poll, and a team that a lot of people think are going to make that playoff with Sam Darnold at quarterback. And I don't think Josh Rosen and his comments recently have made things any easier for Jim Mora at UCLA.
No, or I guess even for Josh Rosen. But I got it I read that entire Q&A, and I'm almost certain that every single person that's criticizing Josh Rosen did not read it.
Well, he didn't say anything that was earth-shattering. He was saying things that are true.
Right, but if you just read the snippets that are pulled,
oh yeah,
the clickbait,
you can twist it around.
He attacks Alabama, or he's just a whiny kid, or whatever. And he wasn't saying that college was hard for him.
No,
he's just saying it was hard. I mean, there's some guys that it is really hard for.
Yeah.
To have to juggle both of those things. But, I mean, all the backlash he's getting, I promise you, those people did not read that thing word for word. They saw the headline. They saw the attention-grabbing clickbait.
Oh, he said Alabama. You say Alabama, and of course that's going to draw a lot of attention.
Yeah, raise the SAT score at Alabama and see if they're still good. He picked Alabama out because Alabama's the best team in the country right now.
Right.
And, you know, and just even if you look at the context around what he was saying about the juggling of school and playing football, that it's not an easy thing to do. And my favorite reaction to him has been he needs to focus on getting his stats better. And like, well, that kind of is proving what he's saying is that these schools aren't really as interested in what these players are doing academically.
Right.
And then so at the end of the day, yes, they're getting college tuition, and that's nothing to scoff at, even though I think they're still more valuable than that to these schools.
Absolutely.
But, okay, there is value in getting a college education and having it paid for, but I think Rosen's point is when all these schools are primarily interested in is keeping guys eligible, they're not getting real educations, and so at the end of it, really, I mean, it's just a meaningless piece of paper that they've got if they get a degree.
Well, I mean, you can go back to, even here at Georgia and the hit piece that Jeremy Shapp did where he was like, he took a class called Principles of Basketball. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, it just goes to show you that, there are some schools and some coaches and some institutions that are really just trying to keep these guys eligible. Look at North Carolina as an example of all the stuff that went down there. So, I mean, it's unfortunate. But at the same time, so many people were blowing this out of proportion because – you know, what Rosen said is, he's talking about wanting to get an MBA and wanting to start his own business. And at one point, I think one of the quotes was, he wanted to own the world or something like that.
And there are some classes that he wanted to take that he couldn't take because it conflicted with his football schedule.
Right.
And, I mean, I Arian Foster brought that up once at Tennessee. He went to Tennessee and wanted to major in something. And they basically told him,
you can't.
You can't because you're here primarily to play football, but – my favorite reaction though is just the shut up and you need to work on your stats is sort of reinforcing Rosen's point of that's why the two don't go hand in hand because people are more interested in we're here primarily to play football unless to get that education.
Well, what time does football practice generally start? The afternoon. College classes don't just quit when football practice starts. There are classes offered throughout the day.
Well, and you're not, and as a football player, you're not just your obligation isn't just to be there for 2 hours during football practice.
No.
Then, I mean, what, your coaches aren't expecting you? I mean, it's like sometimes you hear some of the chirping about Jacob Eason that, he's not as invested in studying the playbook and watching that film or whatever. So, yeah, but that's the thing. You're expected to be at meetings. You're expected to know your playbook. You're expected to watch film. And, it is. It's like a full-time job.
Yeah, and unfortunately, as you alluded to earlier, it's a full-time job with the only benefit being that, you get your education paid for. You get a little bit of a stipend. But, I feel like these kids deserve to have the normal college experience or at least as close to the normal college experience as any other college student does. And unfortunately, they're not really afforded that.
Yeah. And I mean, I read the thing. I didn't just look at the grab your attention headline. And when you read it, I can't believe anyone is like really hypercritical of the things that he said. And except that they just didn't read the thing word for word.
Well, Brain, keep in mind, this is a world where people are getting mad about barbecue being served in the stadium. So
true. Yeah. Or Subway signs.
Ugh, brother. I don't even want to get into the barbecue thing. All I'll say about that before we transition into the Falcons here is that in terms of things that this Georgia fan base has gotten mad about, for me, this is one of the dumbest I've ever heard.
Well, sure, but it is. I think it just speaks to the larger issue right now, which is Georgia's struggling, and mm-hmm. People aren't happy with the direction mm-hmm. of Georgia athletics, and so every little thing now is going to incite you and set you off.
Yeah, that's true. But
Georgia's AD needs to grow a thicker skin, too.
Well, there are things that fans should complain about and should be worried about, and Georgia comes from a tradition of tailgating and things like that to where, I mean, if you are at a good tailgate, you're going to eat anyway. Why are you hungry when you go into the stadium?
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just something that I kind of laughed about there. But it's something that we're talking about because football needs to go ahead and start.
Well, yeah, and here's the thing. The people that were, like, at first griping about the idea that a Tuscaloosa, Alabama institution is going to be served at Sanford Stadium, well, like, some of those people will also be eating it once they are there.
It's like, you know, they serve it at Auburn, too, right? Like, it's served in Auburn Stadium as well.
Yeah, and also Mississippi State.
Right.
Yeah.
So, again, much ado about nothing, in my opinion, and quite frankly, one of the dumber things that this Georgia fan base has gotten mad about.
But it just illustrates how on edge everybody is. And Georgia just needs to have a good football season. And the person who needs Georgia to have a good football season more than anybody is Greg McGarrity.
Yeah, you know, not just anybody, really. I mean, the whole athletic department is kind of on edge based on what the football team does or doesn't do.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's just and stop being so preoccupied with what's on a subway sign on Prince Avenue. I mean, I know. I mean, I'm sure you don't want to be a person in a position that, you know, somebody's like, hey, come in and apply for this person's job on there. But also as the AD, you got to have a thicker skin and just be able to brush that stuff off.
You are listening to The Crossover here on 960theref.com. Don't forget, you can also find us on iTunes. So subscribe and you'll get every episode delivered right to your computer or iPhone or iPad or whatever device that you use.
So Tim Cook could be listening right now.
That's
right. He's
an
Auburn grad.
He is an Auburn grad, yeah. And he runs one of the most successful companies in this entire country.
Right, but you know what? Georgia's 9-2 against them the last 11 years.
I like that. All right, so Devontae Freeman, we'll jump to him now, as he has signed a contract extension with the Falcons, $15 million guaranteed, I believe $41.25 million is the total value of the contract. Or $50 million signing bonus, rather, is what I meant to say there.
But $22 million guaranteed.
$22 million guaranteed, yes. Yeah. So a very good contract for Devontae Freeman. And quite frankly, I think this is a good contract for the Falcons because it didn't extend into the stratosphere like a lot of people thought it was going to. He's pretty much getting paid the top value that running backs have been getting paid for a long time now. I know Steven Jackson, when he was at the Rams, was making about $8 million a year. So I think as far as the salary cap goes, it's not eating up a super big chunk of the cap in terms of what top running backs are making. And I think Devontae Freeman was worth it because he fits the system about as well as any running back you're going to find.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a little bit about about the running backs and how much money he wanted and how much the Falcons should get. And, I mean, I generally think that it's a position now in the NFL which has been devalued to the point that I don't know how much really money you want to be sinking into it. But, you know, I guess that's the one thing. The NFL is a salary cap, and I have no problem with the players getting what they deserve. That's the reason we watch it. So, I mean, I just look at the Falcons signed a guy we all like,
mm-hmm.
is really good.
Yep.
And so I'm glad they're keeping him, and you could figure out, how much that might handicap them down the road from signing other guys. It doesn't sound like it will, though. It does sound like it's basically a 3-year deal.
Right.
And so in 3 years, the Falcons can come back and reassess. And maybe mm-hmm. in that time, you know, maybe Freeman gets fat and happy on the contract and he's not the same player that he's been the last couple of years, but maybe then Tevin Coleman his and they can keep him. Mm-hmm. But I mean, here's the thing. Now, at some point, they're not going to have both of them.
No. I think this probably signals the end for a Tevin Coleman, especially with the drafting of Brian Hill from Wyoming and the signing of Kelvin Taylor, the son of Fred Taylor, who Georgia fans will remember from that game in Jacksonville a few years ago where all Florida did was either run to the left or run to the right. And they ran it down Georgia's throats, and Kelvin Taylor was a big part of that. So the Falcons seem to be trying to find that heir apparent, or at least that option B to Devontae Freeman. And with Tevin Coleman being a guy that will probably be in for some sort of a payday when his contract comes up, he's not going to be around, you would think, unless, like you said, Devontae Freeman ends up not really working out on this contract.
So I think the Falcons still have 2 more years, basically, mm-hmm. though, of Coleman's rookie yep. contract. So, I mean, but coming up, they're going to have to pay Jake Matthews.
And Matt Ryan.
Yeah. I mean, and Ryan's probably got another, like, 3-4 year real just juicy window of his prime. And, you know, keeping Freeman around for that period of time, too, does make sure that the offense stays mostly intact. I mean, because the team is lucky that you've got this real core over these good drafts the last couple of years, that so many of these players on defense now are, you know, Deion Jones, Keanu Neal in their second years. You got McKinley now, Beasley. This will be, what, his third season?
Yeah, I mean, the window is wide open right now.
Right, and I mean, I guess Atlanta doesn't have to worry about really negotiating with those guys. So
right.
They were able to give Freeman a little bit of money, keep him happy, but also keep him around. And you know how these NFL deals work, like we've said, they're – you see 5 years and $41.25 million, but it's really like 3 years and $22 million is all that's guaranteed.
But, I mean, if you look at it right now, the four most important Falcons players on offense, Matt Ryan, Alex Mack, Julio Jones, and Devontae Freeman, aren't going anywhere.
Right. Yeah. And so it's good. I mean, the Falcons were able to keep them and a contract that was good for them. And, you know, it'll keep that offense pretty much together and that glued together for these next couple of years, which is really that window I think Atlanta has with Matt Ryan. Not to say like 3 or 4 years from now that he's just going to fall off a cliff, but I think, what is he now, going into his age 31 or 32 season?
Yeah.
That he probably has like about a 3 or 4 year window, and I think Atlanta's really got to strike and try and get back and win the Super Bowl.
Here's a question for you, though, and we'll transition into some Deshaun Watson talk here in a second. Do the Falcons win a Super Bowl in that window? Like, if you were a betting man, would you put it yes that they do or no that they don't?
I would. It's so hard to win a Super Bowl. I would have to say no.
Okay. They have a very good chance at it.
Yes, but I mean, if you're just saying purely from like if
like
if,
yes or
if,
no,
if
money
you're betting
this,
yes or no, yeah. I mean, I think you have to say no. I mean, plus, I mean, the other thing too, it's the Falcons,
right?
So
they did just blow a 25-point lead in the Super Bowl.
But you know, I mean, the thing with the Falcons, it's as you know, if we take their entire existence starting in 1966, it's easy to sort of laugh them off. But I mean, as we pointed out, last December and January when a team was in the playoffs. Since Atlanta went to its first Super Bowl in 1998, the only team in the NFC that's been to more NFC title games is the Eagles.
No, they've been very successful, particularly since Arthur Blank bought the team. You know, they've been super successful, and they've been a team that continues to not accept mediocrity, and they've made the moves that they've needed to make when they needed to make them. I was one that thought that they probably should have given Dan Reeves another year. That wasn't really fair what happened to him because Michael Vick got hurt, and it's like,
I'm with you. They shouldn't have fired Reeves.
No, but I mean, Jim Mora did a decent job, but they got rid of him when they needed to. And then Mike Smith was doing well, but then he started to get a little stale. They got rid of him when they needed to. And Dan Quinn is coming here and really kind of changed the culture of this Falcons team. They're very young. They're very fast. They're very hungry. That's why I think, personally, that while there could be a step back, and there should be a step back because they had a historically great offensive season last year, I don't necessarily buy into this, hey, don't – give the Falcons a chance to do anything this year, because I think that things are just a little bit different. And I saw a quote from Thomas Dimitroff where he thinks this might be the most talented Falcons roster ever going into this season.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of stuff, too. If you're the GM of the team, you got to be careful, because it is – I mean, this is the NFL, and you walk a real fine line. And I'll even point out last year that – I mean, let's not forget, Atlanta was – they were – I guess they were 7-5, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
then they started putting together those wins in the back end of the season.
Right, they were 7-5 and played the 49ers and Rams.
Mm-hmm.
So it's even like this team last year that made it to the Super Bowl. It's not like they were just this unstoppable force the entire season.
Well, they got hot at the right moment, and the defense got a lot better. That was the key to the transition.
Well, also, they played the two worst teams in the NFL.
They did.
At a point that they were two games over 500.
But that I totally get what you're saying there.
Well,
but
two
I mean,
of the worst teams. I can't leave out the Browns.
They still went into the playoffs and easily handled the Seahawks.
Agreed.
And easily handled, I mean, dominated the Green Bay Packers.
Agreed. But also, the Seahawks game was in Atlanta because the Seahawks lost to the Cardinals in the regular season in, like, week 15. So it's like
I thought it was, like, the last week.
It might have been.
Yeah.
It was, like, the next to last week, maybe the last week. So there's, like, little things. And I don't think the Falcons would have had no chance to win in Seattle because they played them tough there.
Well, they probably should have beaten them when
right,
they did.
It got job. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, that was a big the venue of that game had a lot to do with the outcome of it.
I totally agree with you. And that's why the Falcons need to be a team that does well in the regular season so they can try and get
right
home field.
And I'm not like trying to pour cold water on them or whatever, but if I'm the GM of the team, I mean, that's where you got to step back and think, wait a second now. I mean, you got to be careful because you're just raising the bar and you're getting fans excited. And then what happens if you struggle a little bit? And that's what I would just point out. It's like, this was a team last year you think is so hyper-talented now. They were 7-5 and just happened to play the Niners and Rams in consecutive weeks, and then they were 9-5, and then they beat the Panthers, who had a terrible season. And then they, you know, wrapped it up in the last week of the season in a, what was really a meaningless game against the Saints.
Yeah, and look, I think that this team in particular has a much different experience this season than last season, because last season there wasn't really an expectation. You know, they were kind of under the radar until you got to the playoffs and people were like, okay, this offense is doing really good and they're dominating people. This year, there's a big target on the Falcons' back and there's a lot of expectation.
Yeah, which is hard to live up to.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens time and time again. And just look at the view from Vegas with the season win totals. I mean, the NFC South is the only team by their projections that doesn't have a bad team in it, because you got
right.
the Falcons. I mean, I don't think there's a team worse than eight.
No,
they might have
easily
lowered the Saints, but
it's easily the best quarterback division in football.
Yeah, but I think the Falcons are what, set at like 9.5.
Yeah,
the Panthers I think are back at 9, and then I believe the Bucks and the Saints are at 8.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, the projection is you got a division where every team is like, it, you know, no worse than 500.
Well, and it doesn't help that you're playing against the AFC East, so each team has a game against the Patriots. And, you know, we'll see what happens with Jay Cutler and his Miami Dolphins.
Let's not talk about that.
We can skip that topic. But we'll close things out here on the Crossover Podcast on 960theref.com with a little talk about Deshaun Watson, who made his debut last night. Again, we're recording this on Thursday, so he made his debut Wednesday night in Charlotte, where there was a lot of Clemson orange in the crowd if you watched any of that game. And I thought Deshaun Watson looked fantastic when he got in that game. He was 15-25. He had a rushing touchdown. That rushing touchdown, I mean, you could close your eyes and just listen to them call Deshaun Watson out, and you would think he was playing for Clemson the way that rushing touchdown went. I was just epic, or I mean, peak Deshaun Watson there. But I thought he looked very composed. I thought he spread the ball around pretty well. And even his first throw, like, he gets flushed out of the pocket, throws one across his body over the middle of the field to a tight end who fumbles the ball. But that's not Deshaun Watson's fault, obviously. So overall, I thought Watson looked really good, and I think the future of the Houston Texans with the defense that they have is extremely bright.
Yeah, I mean, I think Watson's going to be a home run for them. I will point out, though, I mean, the defense he was facing last night is probably worse than the defense he faced in January.
It was like
for
second
Alabama.
And third teamers, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, still, I mean, we know what he did the last 2 years against Alabama. He just carved that defense up. But I was just laughing at the, you know, he got in the game and the announcers are like marveling at his poise and everything. And like, well, duh. I mean, yeah.
Did you not watch the last two national title games where 2 years ago he almost beat Alabama single-handedly, and then last year he pretty much did beat Alabama single-handedly.
And so, you know, when he's in the – at that point, probably most of the guys he was playing against last night won't even make the team. They'll end up being cut in a couple of weeks. So,
but if I'm Tom Savage, who's supposed to be the starting quarterback of the Texans, I am looking over my shoulder all the time now after seeing Deshaun Watson play the way he did last
night. But it's like now he's in the NFL, and NFL guys are like, hey, yeah, Deshaun Watson, he was pretty poised and looked pretty good. And like a college football fan is like, well, of course he did.
Well, and they kept asking,
what did you expect?
They kept asking, like, you know, he came from one of those spread offenses where the plays just kind of, you don't really huddle and the plays just kind of called into you. Is he going to be able to run this offense? It's like, what do you think he's been doing for the last 6 months?
Yeah, and like Tom O'Brien is a good offensive coach and also coached in college. Bill O'Brien, yeah, pardon me, and coached briefly for Penn State. Okay. So I think it's a good match because he's got an offensive-minded head coach and the team that needs a quarterback.
Well, and you can look at that division now and look at the quarterback play come out of it, and it's not bad. I mean, Blake Bortles at Jacksonville notwithstanding.
Well, you know, and the interesting thing is where Andrew Luck fits in that pecking order now. I mean, apparently
he might be hurt.
He's hurt.
Yeah.
Like,
so,
he might miss at least the first game, but word is it could be even longer than that.
Well, and if he misses that chunk of time, I think this division really comes down to the Titans and the Texans. And just going ahead and calling Deshaun Watson the quarterback of the future, Marcus Mariota, Deshaun Watson, I think the future of both of those teams is pretty bright. And I think if Deshaun Watson comes in and plays, look, because I don't think Tom Savage is the guy that's going to lead you to a division title, but if Deshaun Watson can come in and kind of have a similar rookie season to, say, like an RG3 had, that team could be the division champs in the, you know, they were already division champs last year, I guess, or, yeah, because they won
lost
that division.
To the Patriots.
That's right. So they were already division champs, but I think they could be a much better team with him under center, and I think the Titans are going to be much better this year. So that division, which has kind of been dominated by the Colts, other than when the Texans have been able to come up and win it, looks like it might be flipping here pretty soon.
Yeah, and that's with the view from Indy, how quickly things changed, because they had Andrew Luck, who looked like this can't-miss guy, and they haven't protected him. They've had a terrible offensive line. Now he's hurt, and it's like, you look at, I mean, would you rather have Mariota and Watson or Andrew Luck?
But Deshaun Watson, very poised, according to the broadcast.
Yeah, wow, I've never seen him so poised. Oh, wait, I have.
All right, that'll wrap up this edition of The Crossover. We'll be back next week with another exciting episode. He's Chris Braem. I'm Sam Franco. Subscribe to us on iTunes so you'll never miss an episode. But, of course, you can always catch us on 960theref.com. Talk to you next week.
You've been listening to The Crossover with Sam Franco and Chris Braem on 960theref.com.